90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender community. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Valinsky.
And Jennifer Renee.
Brian Levinka.
And Glenn Holt. And on tonight's show, Kathy Hubbard of Hubbard Financial Services, Inc., will be here to talk about small nonprofit groups and what they need to know about keeping their records up to date. Then on News Wrap tonight, the Anglican Communion has punished its U.S. branch, the Episcopal Church, for consecrating a second openly queer bishop, while Canadian Anglicans again decide not to decide on blessing same-gender couples. And conservative U.S. House Democrat Ike Skelton of Missouri worries that repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell will force parents to discuss the existence of gays and lesbians with their children. Oh, no. At 9:30, Jesse Garcia will be here to discuss how the Dallas Rainbow Council is working to create dialogue between the Hispanic and GLBT communities in Texas, because both have a common goal, which is full equality. At the top of our second hour, Randall Ellis will be here to talk about what it's like being the executive director of Equality Texas and of Legacy Health Services and working with State Representative Garnett Coleman. Judy Shepherd, the mother of Matthew Shepherd, will be in Houston July 9th and 10th. She has been invited to speak at the Max Kaplan Summer Institute for Educators. She will also speak before a performance of Laramie on July 10th. And there's going to be a book signing for her book, The Meaning of Matthew, My Son's Murder in Laramie. Joe Watts will be here to tell us more about that. And finally, tonight, the feature segment from This Way Out takes a closer look at news this week in the Proposition 8 saga, this time regarding the high-profile federal lawsuit testing the constitutionality of California's anti-gay marriage equality initiative. The case is ultimately expected to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. There is a new documentary, 8, The Mormon Proposition, which investigates the behind-the-scenes but pivotal role played by the Latter-day Saints in swaying the California electorate, an investigation that recently led the California Fair Political Practices Commission to impose a fine on the church for campaign finance violations. All that and more tonight.
This sounds like an exciting show. I'm going to have to listen.
I'm going to hang around and listen to this.
Yes. Me too.
Let's participate.
I think we should.
All right.
Well, a couple of housekeeping rule things here. We want to remind you that if you pledge to KPFT, either in the recent marathon or somewhere way, way, way back, I hope you will fulfill them. You can go to kpft.org. Station elections are coming up, and if you're interested, you can go to our website and find out more information about that. As you know or should know, KPFT is sort of a self-governing organization that has people who are involved in the station and listeners who are involved in the station. So that's a pretty neat thing. Can you believe thing? I mean, there's talk about spending $1.5 billion on redoing the Astrodome, and yet we have no money to do so many other things. It's just incredible.
They've got more money than they've got
sense. Do we need police services or a super fancy Astrodome?
Exactly. Oh. And Pride is in progress.
It is that month?
Yes, and Outsmart. In fact, next week we're going to do a segment on that. The Outsmart has a brand new website. It's really neat.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
It's redesigned. Looks great. And that's probably one of your best places where you can find information on the events, not only the official events, but so many of the other events that are going on in the community around Pride. And there's a number of things going on, a number of organizations that are doing things, which is really great, because that's what it's all about. And actually, there's sort of a Facebook page, and of course, my wonderful Vista computer is just not picking up the internet, but there's a Facebook page talking about taking back Pride in general, not just in Houston, around the country, to bring it back to what it's supposed to mean. You know, the celebration of us as people and not just a party. So all that's going on. And
and when is Pride? When is the parade?
It's a week from Saturday at 8:45 p.m. Lower Westheimer. June 26th. We'll see how wonderful it is this year. They're going to be doing a few different things. The rules have changed a little bit. I went to the Mandatory Pride Parade meeting last week, and they talked about some of the changes. They really didn't talk much about Pride in general, but just sort of the things you could do and can't do and stuff like that.
Speaking of Pride, did you hear where Sharon Osbourne and Kelly Osbourne were grand marshals of the L.A. Pride parade, and anti-gay protesters were alongside the route? And they went after them. Sharon and Kelly went after them with the mic as the parade was going on. Did you hear about that? That was
no, I saw that. I did see that somewhere. Here in Houston, we generally try to ignore them, not to give them any sort of platform, because there's usually so few of them.
Exactly. And you think in L.A. that
they're... L.A.'s a little bit different. And, you know, so each city sort of does it the way they feel it's the most effective. So I didn't see any video on it, but I just heard about that briefly. So that seems real interesting. And, of course, you're listening to Queer Voices.
Waking up here next to you, do you think you could help me find my shoes? I must be a sight. I can't look my best here in this bright, bright morning light. It ain't right.
Music provided to us by J.D. Doyle. That was Coyote Grace, Young and Dumb, from the album Ear to the Ground from 2009. This is Queer Voices.
With us is Kathy Hubbard, who has been part of the community for quite a while, and runs her own financial services that does income tax and financial advice. And what am I missing?
It's bookkeeping and tax services.
Mm-hmm. And you basically specialize in small businesses?
Small business, individuals, nonprofits.
Mm-hmm. Well, and speaking of nonprofits, mm-hmm. you've helped out a number, and we don't have to talk about particular names. You've helped out a lot of nonprofits sort of understand the basics about what they do and what they need to do, and understanding the Internal Revenue Service, which could be a challenge to somebody who may not know anything about that and what they have to do. So what are the challenges for small organizations to be able to deal with those regulations?
Ooh, the service expects a lot of bookkeeping and record keeping, donor tracking from a small group, and one must categorize one's expenses. It's not enough to say this is the cost of some paper, but one must be aware how much of that paper is going to program services versus fundraising or admin. So there's more expectation of accounting for the use of funds than there is even in a for-profit.
What would be one of the things that is forgotten the most, you know, for nonprofits? What do they forget usually that stands out all of them?
Well, the big thing right now is for even the smallest groups who didn't used to even have to file, a group that makes less than $25,000 a year, didn't even have to file anything at all. And then 3 years ago, law came in that they needed to at least file what they call an electronic postcard. They need to go online and fill out their name and the organization information, you know, who's contact person, email. And that was it every year. Just sort of check in. Well, some small groups went and passed this third year deadline. If they're calendar year groups, then they may have missed the May 10th deadline. But there's still a bit of hope out there. You know, even if they realize they haven't filed their little online electronic postcard in the last 3 years, they should still jump online and do it, because I think when they do get around to really writing them off the list, they'll probably cut them a break anyway if they went ahead and did it a bit late than if they don't do it at all.
You know, Elroy Forbes, who unfortunately is no longer with us, mm-hmm. used to keep a directory of nonprofit groups in the greater Houston area, mm-hmm. and he said that he knew of at least about 5,000, which is just incredible. And of course, many of them are real small, and certainly us at this table here have worked with, have volunteered, have been part of some of these small organizations over the years, and in fact, it is my understanding, and I don't know how far back you go with the history, but it used to be very difficult for a GLBT organization to originally get a nonprofit. We're going back 20, 30 years, and a lot of the organizations mm-hmm. back then used to never use the GL word. They used to use Human Rights Campaign, Montrose Activity Center here in Houston.
Mm-hmm. Dignity, yeah.
Yeah, and all of these different names that really didn't sort of trigger what they were. And, of course, now things are a little bit different. And back then, a lot of these organizations were really, well, Pacifica Radio mm-hmm. Had problems in the early years because Well, this was more of an FCC, a Federal Communications problem, because they didn't know how to classify a non-commercial station that was not associated with a school or university, that it was sort of out on its own. And, of course, years later, National Public Radio, and there's lots of community radio stations around. But that was sort of how things have changed a little bit. And a lot of our organizations in the earlier days, especially those ones that were political, a lot of people didn't want to even give their names because they were afraid their name would get out in public and they could get fired. So we've come a long way in the fact that, you know, we can be organizations now, but and I don't know if there's a scare tactic of them looking at our organizations. But in reality, any one of our organizations, if they want to continue, they need to follow the rules, because you never know down the road if you're trying to provide services, you're trying to help people out, you're trying to raise money for other organizations, you need to cross your T's and dot your I's.
Well, just like individuals, if you aren't taking care of your business life or your tax life properly, then you might not enjoy and appreciate an inspection. I mean, not that anyone would, but, you know, you would certainly be on the downside of any kind of audit or review of your own life. So the same with organizations. And there are all kinds of additional rules for the nonprofit, such as you can't be... You're there for the class that you're serving, for, you know, the poor, or ending discrimination, or promoting a diversity, whatever your mission is that you've got to prove for. You're not there to benefit the board of directors, and, you know, you're not there to give the assets away to other people or groups, or, you know, you have to be very careful that you keep in touch with your mission and keep an eye on why you are exempt. And yes, raising money, and we all fundraise for the good cause, but we didn't get exemptions to raise these funds. You know, we got exemptions for the cause, and so you have to make sure that your sources of revenue are, you know, coming for charitable.
Is there a certain percentage that an organization has to do?
Well, on the charitable, different organizations have different percentage formulas. A social club, country club, something can only get certain, like a minimus, you know, 15% or less from non-members. But charities, you want over half of your income. You want half or more of your revenues to be for your purposes, you know, coming in for that. So there, you know, there's just lots of classifications.
Well, and there's a number of organizations that have been questioned in the past because they spend so much money on the fundraising effort itself rather than getting the money out to the community.
And that's where the groups, again, try to spend at least half of what, you know, a nice goal is to be spending half the gross. You know, if your fundraiser only nets you about 10%, then maybe you want to look for different methods, because that's a lot of volunteer energy that's spent, you know, running around town gathering up restaurant passes to auction instead of doing something that might be closer to the mission.
Or spending a ton on the talent, rental space. And somebody, Kim Klein, who talked about this, who I went to a workshop once at the NGLTF Creating Change Conference, and she talked about the best way to raise money is ask people. But sometimes we're so afraid to do that we'd rather put on the big, you know, show. One of the things also is, like, can a nonprofit work towards change politically? And I know this, you know, you're not going to give the definitive actual, because I'm sure there's tons and tons of regulations on that, but can a nonprofit work towards change?
Yes. Yes, of course. I mean, change is at the core of why many groups exist. So it's how one goes about it that where you get into the rules and regulations. I mean, the organization cannot endorse or support a candidate, but organizations can advocate for their causes, and they can inquire, they can urge for the support of their causes and the issues that surround them, and educate as to what is going on. You know, this, you know, if you do this, if you fail to have a policy in your schools, then there is no repercussion for someone calling the kids names, you know. So,
and there's certain boundaries of where they can go and do lobbying, correct?
Right. There are some organizations that have put out some good papers that are on the internet that you start Googling for, political action and charitable concerns, and you'll start coming up with some of the papers that explain how to get right up to the edge of this Grand Canyon, if you will, and not slip down the side.
Exactly.
So. If I were a group of people who wanted to become a 501c3 educator, what are the procedures we have to go through?
Well, nowadays, they're pretty clearly spelled out on the IRS's website. You know, when I first started doing this, when Jack and I were working years ago, there was hardly able to find the information. There was one book out by Houston's own Jody Blazek, and kind of told you about some of the procedures, but you have to fill out an application where they want money, of course, to process it, and you want to put out several years' worth of budgets, how you're going to raise your money from, what kinds of activities are you going to do, you're going to have members, what is the cause, what is the mission statement, who's paying for what. You know,
we certainly went through that with Pride, because Pride for a number of years was sheltered under the Montrose Activity Center.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, it was sort of like this Phoenix organization that Ray used to love to talk about. We would start up in February, go through the year, hopefully have a little bit of money left over, and then disband in July. And it was sort of that cycle we did every year. And then we got under the Montrose Activity Center, which at one time was the community center. But they sort of sheltered us. And then at a time when Pride starts to get a little bigger and the Montrose Activity Center wanted to go back to being a community center, we sort of split. So we sort of had this interesting thing where we sort of had a history, but we also wanted to be new. And that took a process for a while. And you sort of have to run as a nonprofit where they temporarily, I don't know how the rules are now, but we try to do everything just the way we were supposed to so that we had no problems. And that, I think, is really a good lesson, is that it's good to get somebody who knows the rules so that you know what you're doing is the right way to do it, because once you get in trouble, it's harder to get out of trouble.
Yeah, Pride was, when Pride applied, we were just still coming out of that era where anything with gay or lesbian written in it was suspect. And so we were very careful about public celebration and you know, community strengthening. And, you know, we didn't sell souvenirs, that we had commemorative memorabilia. And
I know that for the Houston Transgender Unity Committee, it seemed like it was an inordinately long period of time to finally get it. Are we seeing it a little simpler or quicker to get a 501c3, or is the same time period necessary to become a nonprofit?
The communities, the transgender application that took a long time, there was struggle. There was the struggle of presenting the medical research and that it is gaining more and more awareness in the world that this is the way it is. You know? And so it was keeping that track and keeping that stand. It was overcoming some resistance and just passing it on to managers before somebody said, "Oh, please, yes." You know,
so somewhere within the federal government,
reviewer, somebody just couldn't hand it to the manager. Just you know, da 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 da. Which and Pride, I think, was kind of unique and lucky that it went through so quickly. But in the 70s, for example, the caucus tried, the caucus is a couple of parallel organizations. You have the political action group, and you have just the social welfare organization, if you will. And that's a C4. I mean, it's not pure enough politically or not, you know, that it could be a C3. But it'll too much advocacy. But so it's a C4. I mean, the revenue it takes in is still exempt from income tax, and it's, you know, it tried in the 70s for tax exemption, and it was, you know, soundly rebuffed. Oh no, anything to do with homosexuals is political. Said, well, yes, but you know, nonetheless, and so it was very healing and very heartwarming to receive it. In the late 80s, mm-hmm. 90s, to finally receive that recognition.
And it should be noted that these tax forms that are filled out are public information.
Yes, your application is public information, and the current 3 years of returns are. If one has a website, often it's easy enough just to post them there, or a portal is handy if someone emails.
And there's a great website called GuideStar.org mm-hmm. that you can, even for free, you can look them up. For paying a fee, you can get a lot more information, but basically you could look up and you can look at these what are called the 990 forms, is that mm-hmm. correct, that are the tax forms that give you a lot of detail of what the organization does, the money it brought in. Sometimes, and I don't know, you know these rules better than I, the salaries of some of the officers. There's a threshold of how that's done. And that's really sort of a good way to sort of look at what these organizations do.
That is. Now, if you're trying to find out what the local director of the Red Cross makes, you might not have any luck, because if they're consolidating and just running it out of the New York, running everything, then you might not find out. But yes, there are rules that where you have to post the highest paid executives and the highest paid contractors.
Now, I know it's good policy that the board of directors don't get compensated, but are there rules for that?
Well, there's...
Does that get complicated?
Well, you know, the smaller the group gets, the harder it is to have so many separate hats, because they do want an independent board of directors which would not be connected to, you know, other missions, a crisis phone bank. They wouldn't want board of directors who maybe own the local phone company. But if you're talking sometimes with a very small group, it can be hard to find someone who is not without, you know, who is at least 6 degrees of connection from the core of the group. But yeah, that's groups should have their ethical policies. They should have conflict of interest policies signed and every year by the board members. The board members understand what is perceived as a conflict mm-hmm. of interest in this group. And
so there's a lot to it.
There's a lot to it, but the information is there if you like you know, dry reading if you really want to read about it. But, you know, have a bottle of water handy because it is dry, dry, dry.
Well, Kathy Hubbard, how could somebody get in contact with you if they have some questions on this or need some guidance in getting their organization up and going or have some concerns?
Well, they can call the office, although I will say the my practice, as far as my business is going, is full. I'm pretty busy these days, and so we're not really in a position of being able to take new projects and so forth like I did in the old days. But I can still certainly steer people to sources of information. And so.
And what's your phone number?
713-522-9000.
Kathy, thank you very much for joining us. Kathy Hubbard with Hubbard Financial Service. We really appreciate this information. I'm sure this will help out a lot of the organizations that may be listening to us. You're listening to Queer Voices.
Thanks. I'm Jen Mahoney.
And I'm Pam Marshall.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending June 12, 2010. The rupture over the inclusion of lesbians and gay men in the global Anglican Communion, which has more than 77 million congregants worldwide, grew even wider this week. It erupted following the consecration in 2003 by the Episcopal Church, the U.S. Anglican branch, of openly gay and partnered Bishop Gene Robinson of New Hampshire. That spurred vocal outrage by Anglican traditionalists, based primarily in African, South American, and Asian provinces of the Communion, who adhere to biblical condemnations of homosexuality. Some not only oppose openly queer clergy, but women holding those positions. And now, the Episcopal Church has been removed by Archbishop of Canterbury Rowan Williams, the spiritual leader of the Communion, from Anglican committees that engage other Christian denominations in discussion of doctrinal issues. The move followed the Episcopalians' consecration last month of a lesbian bishop, Mary Douglas Glasspool, in Los Angeles. According to the Reverend Kenneth Kieran, Secretary General of the Anglican Communion, in a letter this week quoted by Religion News Service, "After Robinson's consecration, all 44 member churches in the Anglican Communion were asked to abide by three moratoria: no more gay bishops, no official blessings for same-sex unions, no interfering in each other's provinces."
The Episcopal Church initially agreed to abide by those directives, but its governing body last year voted to end its moratorium on the consecration of openly lesbi-gay bishops, setting the stage for Bishop Glasspool's elevation. In comments while she was attending the General Synod of the Anglican Church of Canada this week, Episcopal Presiding Bishop Catherine Jeffert Shorey said that, "I don't think it helps dialogue to remove some people from the conversation. For the Archbishop of Canterbury to say to the Methodists or the Lutherans that we only have one position is inaccurate. We have a variety of understandings, and no, we don't have consensus on hot-button issues at the moment. Part of the Church's mission is to gay and lesbian people," she added. "Where's the good news in this for them?"
And the Anglican Church of Canada wrestled with the contentious issue of blessing same-gender marriages, which have been legal in the country since 2005, at its tri-annual gathering of clergy and lay leadership this week in Halifax, Nova Scotia. A few local congregations have already been celebrating same-gender unions. But at its last national gathering in Winnipeg, Manitoba in 2007, the Anglican Church of Canada decided against granting official permission to individual priests who wanted to conduct those ceremonies. And after numerous discussions conducted in small groups throughout the nine-day event in Halifax this week, the church decided not to make a legislative decision on the issue. A resolution was approved to continue to engage in theological and scriptural study of human sexuality and to include the voices of gays and lesbians in those discussions. The Anglican Church of Canada has not officially approved the blessing of same-gender unions, so it remains in compliance with the Anglican moratoria. But the Most Reverend Fred Hiltz, primate of the Anglican Church of Canada, joined Episcopal Presiding Bishop Jeffert Shorey in expressing distress at the Archbishop of Canterbury's sanctions against the Episcopal Church.
The Protestant Church of Iceland has also not yet decided on blessing the country's same-gender civil unions. The issue was renewed this week after lawmakers there unanimously replaced civil unions with marriage equality. All 49 members of the country's parliament approved the measure on June 10th. It adds man and woman and woman to Iceland's marriage laws. The legislation also allows churches to perform same-gender weddings if they wish, and says ministers will always be free to perform those marriage ceremonies, but never obliged to. The country's president has to approve the bill, but is highly likely to do so. Same-gender marriage has generally been a non-issue in Icelandic politics. The country boasts the world's only openly queer head of state, lesbian prime minister, Jóhanna Sigurðardóttir. She took office last year when her Social Democrats formed a progressive coalition with the left-green movement.
In predominantly Roman Catholic Portugal, Teresa Pirish and Helena Paixão, divorced mothers in their 30s who've been together since 2003, were wed in a 15-minute ceremony at a Lisbon registry office on June 7th, becoming Portugal's first legally married same-gender couple. They've been trying to marry since 2006 when a registry office refused to issue a license to them. They appealed to the country's constitutional court, which rejected their bid. But lawmakers in the center-left socialist government passed a marriage equality law in January. President Aníbal Cavaco Silva, a political conservative, reluctantly signed it in May, acknowledging that the parliament had enough votes to override a veto. After exchanging vows, the activist newlyweds promised to continue the fight for adoption rights, which the legislation specifically prohibited. Elsewhere in Europe, same-gender marriage is also legal in Belgium, the Netherlands, Norway, Spain, Sweden, and soon, Iceland.
But a spokesperson for the Center for the Development of People, the Malawi LGBT advocacy group that supported embattled queer couple Tawange Chimbalanga and Stephen Manjeza, told CNN this week that the couple has broken up. They were arrested for holding what was considered an illegal public engagement party in December in the southern African nation, convicted of unnatural acts between men, and sentenced to the maximum penalty of 14 years hard labor, only to be pardoned last week by President Bingu wa Mutharika. He seemed to be bowing to international criticism of the couple's prosecution, but said they would be arrested again if they break his country's harsh laws against same-gender sex. According to Malawi's Daily Nation newspaper, Manjeza is now dating a woman. Chimbalanga, who identifies as transgender, told reporters that she still loves Manjeza but might seek asylum in another country. Manjeza called Chimbalanga gay trash, who told me there were many countries willing to take us, but I told him I was not interested and would not go, Manjeza said. I know there are people on a mission to lure me into doing things against my wish. I will not relent. I am not a fool. Manjeza's new girlfriend, Dorothy Gulo, told The Nation that she is looking forward to a future with him. I don't care what people say, but I am yet to tell my parents.
Elsewhere, more than 3 million people celebrated LGBT Pride in Sao Paulo, Brazil, on June 6th. Now, in its 14th year in South America's largest city, it's considered to be the biggest such event in the world. Along with the usual music blasting from sound trucks and colorful floats, sometimes scantily clad, strutting and dancing marchers paraded under blue skies down skyscraper-lined Avenida Paulista. This year's theme, Vote Against Homophobia, signaled a more political tone than in some previous years. Organizers said that LGBT activists would push candidates leading up to October's presidential election in Brazil to support full equality for sexual minorities. Private, consensual, adult, same-gender sex is legal there, and Brazil outlawed discrimination based on sexual orientation in 1988. But anti-queer violence remains a serious problem. Some 200 Brazilians were killed in homophobic attacks last year.
The victims of last year's murderous rampage at an LGBT youth group meeting in Tel Aviv were remembered in the Israeli beachside city's annual Pride Parade on June 10th. A minute of silence was held prior to the start of the march to honor the two who were killed and 11 injured last August when a masked gunman entered Tel Aviv's LGBT community center and sprayed young people attending a support group meeting with automatic weapons. He has never been found. Speakers at the start of the march included Ayala Katz, mother of Near Katz, a 26-year-old youth counselor who died in the attack. The parade kicked off at Meir Park in the center of Tel Aviv and finished with a dance party at Gordon Beach. According to Israeli media, some 100,000 people, including drag queens, civil rights activists of all sexual orientations, and marchers wearing skimpy bathing suits, waved rainbow flags and danced to techno music in the scorching heat, making it the country's largest ever LGBT pride parade. A small group of queer activists waving red flags held a separate march to call for greater equality for all Israeli communities, including its Arab minority, which makes up nearly 20% of the population. Israel is widely seen as having the most progressive LGBT rights policies in the Middle East, despite hostility towards sexual minorities by the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community.
And Agence France-Presse reported that an estimated 3,000 Greek gays and lesbians and their supporters marched through the center of Athens on June 5th in that city's annual Pride Parade. The theme was "We Are Everywhere," and a banner acknowledging the country's current fiscal uncertainties read, "Fighting discrimination and the economic crisis is the same battle." Greek lawmakers approved a form of civil unions for same-gender couples in 2008, but activists have been pushing for full marriage equality.
And finally, U.S. homophobes continue to use children as pawns in their opposition to LGBT rights. Conservative Missouri Democrat Ike Skelton, who chairs the U.S. House Armed Services Committee, said this week that he opposes repeal of the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy banning service by open gays and lesbians, in part because he wants to avoid a national discussion about homosexuality. During a media breakfast, he asked, "What do mommies and daddies say to their 7-year-old child?" Skelton told reporters that no one in his district has raised the issue with him, but that "my biggest concern is the families," obviously referring only to those headed by heterosexual couples. He apparently wants to protect those children from knowing that happy, healthy, and productive lesbians and gay men actually exist. Lots of luck with that one, Ike.
That's News Wrap for the week ending June 12, 2010, written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. You can read the text of this week's News Wrap online at www.thiswayout.org.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Pam Marshall.
And I'm Jen Mahoney.
This is Queer Voices.
Those of you who listen to this show often know that every once in a while we talk to John Wright from the Dallas Voice because he's a full-time reporter covering issues up in Dallas, but also issues that go on around the state. And the Dallas Voice has a wonderful website and wonderful RSS feed of stuff that goes on in the state and the community, really interesting stuff. And if you know how to set up your reader or just go to that, you can really learn a lot of information about what's going on. So when we were talking to John Wright, he says, somehow, I don't know how we got into this discussion, but he says that in Dallas there is a LGBT LULAC chapter. And I just found that so interesting. And the fact that, you know, what we work on here in Pacific, and I know Jennifer and I work on this, is all about building community.
Absolutely.
And I just thought this was so interesting. So on the line with us from Dallas, we have Jesse Garcia, who is head of the LULAC 4871. Is that correct?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Good evening. This is Jesse Garcia, president of LULAC Council 4871.
Well, tell us about the history of putting this chapter together and how it is that you were able to work in, like, two communities that don't always work together very well.
Well, if you remember back in 2005, we were the GLBT community in Texas was handed a blow with the same-sex marriage amendment.
Yes, right.
And the people in Dallas, the activists, were very, very upset. We worked really hard. We knew that not that many people were going to come out in that off-year election, so we tried to do as much outreach to other communities as possible. And when we were looking at numbers, we saw the who came out to vote, and they broke it down by race. We saw that Hispanics were like 55 voting in favor.
Really?
44. Yeah. So it was not as bad as other communities. So we sat down and said, okay, we need to go and do some outreach, but serious, face-to-face talking about our issues to other communities. we just took for granted that the Democrats were going to come out and help us out on this, but only 11% of the voter electorate turned out for that event.
Right. Now, Jesse, did you really think that we had a chance of winning this?
When you're an activist and your rights on the line, you have to be an optimist.
Yes, absolutely.
I was asked the same question by an editor of the Texas Triangle. It was a lady, and she goes, really, you think you're going to have a chance to defeat this in the most reddest of states? And I go, when your life is on the line, you think you can do anything, especially when you're empowered by your message and stuff. So, yeah, it hurt to see 76% vote against you. But what we took away from that loss, was empowerment to go do even more work on behalf of our cause. And that's when we said, okay, I was a member of Stonewall Democrats of Dallas, and I decided, okay, for the next 2 years, I'm going to be reaching out to the Hispanic community. And along the way, I had met some people, gay Latinos, who were involved in DULAC already. They're already members, but they had never formed a council. LULAC, the way it's set up, there's councils in the community, which we call adult councils, and then young adult councils in colleges, and then youth councils in high school. We have over 700 councils in the United States and Puerto Rico, and we were the very first one that was forming that was going to be known as the Gay LULAC Council.
Yes.
Not in Miami, not in New York, but in Dallas of all places.
Fabulous.
And it took off. The idea was kicked around as the 2005 vote was coming up. But we're so busy trying to, like, get the vote out to vote this Prop 2 thing down that we put it in the back burner. But then the following year, when the mega marchers, if you remember, 500,000 people marched down the streets of downtown Dallas
yes.
in 2006, a lot of the gays showed up to support the immigration cause. And we were empowered by that, seeing that part of the community come out, you know, for immigrants. So we're like, it's time to do this, and let's do this, of course, with a serious effort. And when we launched June 12, 2006, in the middle of the neighborhood in Dallas, we had our national LULAC leaders actually come down and inaugurate this council.
So you had support from LULAC in general?
At the beginning, yes, there was some, how do you call it, concern of the name, because we had Gay LULAC in front of it. But it was mainly because people were worried about their branding. They're like, okay, what if, I think one of the reasons why they were concerned, because they did a Google search, and of course when our website hit, we did it nice and pretty, and we started getting lots of hits. So when you would Google LULAC, one of the very first things that would come up would be Gay LULAC. People got scared, like, oh my God, what's going on? But at the end of the day, when they talked to us and they saw that our efforts were about civil rights, because at the end of the day, LULAC is a civil rights organization, they started knowing where we're coming from. And we're not taking over anyone's agenda. We're about building bridges.
Exactly.
And we've been successful. In the last 4 years, we've already won Council of the Year statewide. We just won it this past weekend. So we're very excited. We're very excited, and we feel like we've been accepted by not only the state, but the national LULAC leadership.
How many members do you have?
We have, we're one of the largest councils in Texas. We're already hitting 80 paid members.
Wow. That's
great.
The average
council is probably like around 15 to 20 members, but we're already at 80.
So do you go around to the other councils to sort of introduce yourself and let them know what you're about and explain that you are about building bridges?
What we do a lot of community projects together, because one of the things that we do with LULAC, we're either raising money for scholarships, uniting around a civil rights cause in the community, or we have our general meetings where we invite speakers, and then we have our district conventions, because we have our state conventions and district conventions. Well, at the district convention, they were able, the youth and young adults were able to, and the other adult councils in the North Texas area, were able to interact with the Gay LULAC members. And it's been sort of like a great way of building bridges, because we've been able to have actual LGBT acceptance. We first called them tolerance. We didn't like that term anymore. We want acceptance in that title.
Yes, I like LGBT. That. Yes.
Yeah, and LGBT equality. We're able to have these conference of these sessions at our district and our state convention, and it was greatly attended. And some of the people that I was surprised that showed up were the grandmothers, the abuelitas, from that are part of LULAC, the old timers, sat down and basically learned about the words lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender. They learned about Don't Ask, Don't Tell. They learned about ENDA, and they learned about the Federal Marriage Amendment, you know? And it was a lot of, like, the fear of the unknown at the beginning, but once in a while, you would see somebody, like, want to, like, say something, but then they were afraid to in the sessions. But later on, everybody just came up to us afterwards, and it says, I have a cousin, or I have a grandson.
Yeah, that seems everybody to be the way it is.
Everybody has one in the family, but they're just afraid to talk about it. So I feel like we're having those discussions that needed to be had, and especially if you're going to be a civil rights activist, you got to know that you're fighting for people's rights, and you can't just distinguish one person from another. We're all human rights activists, and we have to put it all on par. We're all on the same equal plane.
We're talking to Jesse Garcia, who is calling in from Dallas, and he's talking about the Dallas Rainbow Council. It's a LULAC council. Now we move to the year 2010, and we're seeing this pushback by certain people that are organizing or trying to get back into power that are really trying to put off the Hispanic community and bring this whole immigration issue in. And, I mean, it's just these scare tactics, sort of the same scare tactics they used about gay marriage, you know,
exactly.
8 years ago. So
they first came for the gays, and now they're coming for the immigrants. And now the Hispanic community is seeing how it's important to be sticking up for other minorities in the United States. For the past 2 years, I've been going to LULAC, and I actually got to present resolutions at the National Convention to support the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and to support a fully inclusive ENDA, and they got by wide margins. It was almost unanimous that those bills got, the resolutions got passed at the National Convention to support the gay community.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you for that inclusive ENDA.
You're welcome. This year, I decided to turn the tables, and our group decided, let's engage the LGBT community on immigration reform.
Yes.
Because the Hispanic community is basically being attacked left and right. They make it seem like everyone's coming over from Mexico, when actually the majority of the people that are in the United States and undocumented came over on expired visas, you know? So we have to combat all this myths and facts out there about immigration. And the people that know, who have been second-class citizens, who have been treated like dirt by those right-wing people that are targeting immigrants, should know where we're coming from. And I've been having discussions with at least five. We've counted at least 500 activists that we've talked to in the past 6 months, gay rights activists, whether it be political groups like Stonewall Chapters or the Human Rights Campaign locally, or the Creating Change Conference that came to Dallas. We were able to have a session there. We had 80 people attend our session, and we were able to say, you know, immigration is not just a Hispanic issue. There's also binational couples, LGBT couples that are 37,000 of them,
yes,
that are at any day now could be separated because they don't have a partner rights to keep their partner here like straight couples do. And then there's also the immigrant children who are gay, who would benefit by having the DREAM Act passed. In exchange for college or military, they could earn their citizenship. But that bill, there's so many, it's got bipartisan support. We just need to get it out on the floor, and then you would see all these children who were brought here very young with no say of their own. They've learned American history. They speak English with an American accent. All they know is America. that they just don't have the citizenship.
Right. And there's even a pullback on people born here that they want to deny citizenship.
Oh, Arizona, most recently, wants to deny birthright citizenship, something that's guaranteed by the Constitution.
Exactly.
And there's a congressman trying to repeal certain aspects of the 14th Amendment.
It's craziness. It is craziness. And then it's just... sometimes you feel like, really, this is all you got. You can't concentrate on passing these crazy laws against immigrants, like the ones you passed against gays. Did that create a job? Did that put food on somebody's table? You know, did you improve education in any way? These are just red meat that's being thrown to voters just to get them out to vote. And at the end of the day, it doesn't create community. It doesn't make your community better. It just divides us.
And I know certainly here in Houston, there's a real challenge of getting Hispanic people out to vote. And it's sort of a catch-22. Are needs being addressed by the general people running for office? And then there's the other side. Well, needs won't be addressed unless you go out and vote. So that's a real concern here, and I'm sure there's some parallels all around the country.
Yes, in Dallas, we've talked about the Hispanic vote. You got to realize that half of the people in the United States are under age 18. We're a very young population. And then the half that are above 18, half of them are undocumented. And then you take that other half that only is registered to vote, and the other half is not. You know, it gets like half and half and half,
yes,
and half that number.
Yes.
Eventually, when it's like 1/16, those are the ones that turn out to vote at the federal elections. So what we're doing now, we're taking all this anger that we're seeing in the Hispanic community, and we're trying to channel it to voter registration for those who are documented citizens, are U.S. citizens. We're challenging them to register to vote and turn out in November. And the ones who are permanent residents that can become U.S. citizens, because there was an estimated, like the last time I checked was back in 2006, there was an estimated 8 million people who were, all you need to do was take that test and become citizens. 8 million voters.
Wow.
You know? So it's sort of like we need to move our community forward. But the way we got to do it is we got to let them know what's happening in Arizona. You got Debbie Riddle out of Houston, Tombaugh, proposing the same thing.
Yes.
You know?
Oh,
it's not
going
to go anywhere because we've already lined up our forces in the legislature to make sure that that doesn't happen. And then Rick Perry said that this won't fly in Texas. But I've battled with Riddle, and she's going to make this her number one thing come 2011. So we need to gear up that. I mean, we need to remind our folks, you know, there's just no excuse for not going to the polls.
Well, Jesse, this is incredibly fascinating, and it's a great sort of a bringing together of two different communities, or actually one and the same in reality.
Yeah, thank you for this good work.
How can people find out more information about the LULAC Council 4871?
You could Google Gay LULAC, or you could go to LULAC, that's LULAC, 4871. .org. And the Texas LULAC State Director, Joey Godinez, who's from Louise, Texas, south of Houston, he's told me that he wants me to form gay LULAC councils all over Texas because we're the most organized. He says that we do a lot of good groundwork, good grassroots work. So I challenge people in El Paso, San Antonio, Houston, Fort Worth, Brownsville to get out there, get your gay Latinos together, and let's start making some new chapters.
That sounds great.
Jesse, thank you very much for joining us. And, of course, there's also a link on the Queer Voices website to your website. And keep up the good work, and we'd love to talk to you again and hopefully talk about some of the incredible progress you continue to make.
When you come to Houston, come visit us.
Will do. Thank you so much for this opportunity. I feel very blessed to be with you all tonight.
You're listening to Queer Voices.
The big oil companies want to build a pipeline from the tar sands in Canada to the refineries on the Texas Gulf Coast. The 1,700 miles of pipe will endanger 32 of Texas' lakes and rivers. The National Response Center reports that since January 2009, roughly 253,000 gallons of crude have been spilled across Texas in five separate pipeline events. The State Department's window for public comments closes on June 16th. To get your voice heard, visit their website today. Go to action.sierraclub.org/stopthepipe and make your voice heard. You've been listening to 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Listeners support KPFT in many different ways. Some write checks and others use credit cards. But if you're spinning your wheels looking for a tax deduction, think about donating your working but unwanted car, motorcycle, boat, or truck to KPFT. You'll qualify for a tax deduction and at the same time take care of that unfinished business. To make a donation, call our toll-free vehicle donation hotline at 877-308-2408. We'll arrange for your vehicle to be picked up and the title transferred. Then we'll send you a receipt for your tax deduction. It's that simple to support the station you've come to rely on for alternative music, news, and public affairs programming. Again, for more information or to make a donation, call our toll-free vehicle donation hotline at 877-308-2408. You're tuned in to commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston, radio for people.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Hey! Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy. This way.
With us this evening is Randall Ellis, and Randall Ellis has been a long-time, incredibly hard worker for this community. Randall has worked with and sort of continued to work with Garnett Coleman.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Never stopped working for Garnett.
Yes, exactly.
Yay, Garnett.
In some of the wonderful work that Garnett does, Randall was executive director of... You started actually when it was LGRL?
Yeah, I started and finished when it was the Lesbian Gay Rights Lobby of Texas.
Okay.
And when I left, they figured they couldn't top that, so they changed the name to Equality Texas.
Right, and then split your job like four ways because you were doing
absolutely.
So much.
Absolutely. The organization over the, you know, through my time there and through Paul Scott, who came in after I left, has gone through enormous growth, and so they've been able to split things up.
Right, and now you're working with Legacy. And so what exactly do you do with Legacy?
I do everything with Legacy. You know, I'm lucky. I get to work at the federal, state, and local level for issues that are important to Legacy, which include the LGBT community, includes HIV care, includes health care for the entire community of people within Houston who are uninsured or underinsured that don't have access. And we look at issues, for example, as immigration. I'm working right now with my board on crafting a policy statement that will direct how we do our advocacy efforts around immigration reform over the next, I hope it's less than a year, but that could be strung out to be 4 or 5, I don't know how many years. So
with the changes in healthcare, how is that affecting the HIV community and the way that people can get medication? And
right.
What's going on with that? I know that we have a lot of listeners and a lot of people in our community that are very concerned about this.
Absolutely.
So.
And we had a scare last fall when Ryan White, which is the federal funding that funds how we provide HIV care at Legacy and how a lot of lower-income folks within the Houston area and across the United States receive their care for HIV. It was real. Authorized, and that goes until 2013. So I don't expect to see much difference in the way that HIV care is given to our patients through 2013. Certainly funding issues are always going to be a problem, and we're constantly fighting for that. In fact, you know, we gave away about $1 million in uncompensated care because the Ryan White funds wouldn't cover it. But starting in 2014, when Medicaid kicks in for a larger portion of the Texas population, our statistics at Legacy show 76% of our clients who are currently on Ryan White will now be covered under Medicaid. I think the Planning Council, Ryan White Planning Council, has looked at their numbers for all of Harris County and for all the areas that they serve, and it's about 60% of clients that are given HIV care in Harris County will switch over to a Medicaid form. And what that Medicaid form of care looks like, we don't know.
Well, and it's sort of interesting because, first of all, nobody expected people to live this long.
Absolutely.
You know, the fact that the drugs are working,
mm-hmm.
The fact that people are living longer is incredible, but then there's all these other problems and concerns about how do you do this. And the whole care system has changed, too. And it's actually, you know, something that Deborah Danberg said many years ago, who used to be our state representative.
Right.
Gay men were never experts on health because they didn't need to. Basically, when we had a problem, we got a shot and, you know, it was taken care of. But things changed so much with HIV/AIDS and going through all this and then losing a lot of people, we've had to learn the system. And Legacy has also expanded to not just be a GLBT organization,
right,
but to serve people who do not have any other ability to get care.
Primary care across the board. We currently have four locations, one in the Greenway Plaza, which is tightly and associated with our work here in Montrose. So that's where we specialize in HIV care between those two locations. But our clinic out in Fifth Ward, the new clinic that we merged with in the Gulfton area, serve two totally different populations. In the Fifth Ward, it's 50% Hispanic, 50% African American, and dealing with everything from a physical for school to an earache. In Gulfton, we deal with a large immigrant population, and we do a lot of prenatal care and care for children.
Well, you've all expanded. Certainly, the people with AIDS have the demographics have changed.
Oh, the demographics of, you look at just our clinic in Montrose, which was what it was when I started 5 years ago. We just had one clinic and gone through enormous growth, but they reflected exactly. If you looked at the demographics, they looked exactly like the epidemic did here in Houston, and so it wasn't only a white gay male disease, but more than 50% of our clients are still gay men. And if you look at the epidemic, more than 50% of the people living with HIV are still gay men. So it is an issue that disproportionately affects our community more than any other community. Although you see statistics for African American women, Latino women on the rise, we go out, we know a lot more people within our peer group that are living with HIV and for whom it's an issue.
Now, how is Legacy reaching the younger generation that maybe didn't see the HIV deaths and people that died from AIDS? How are we kind of making it relevant to them in an age where you take a pill and you know, it's kind of, there's a lot of apathy?
Yeah, no, you know, I started HIV at an interesting time 14 years ago at AIDS Foundation Houston doing education right when protease inhibitors mm-hmm. came out. And so that was a major transformation from a death sentence to a manageable disease, and it's become more manageable over that 14 years. And so the message that we've had to give to younger gay men has become more complex and delivered in different ways than when I was doing it on the streets of Montrose or hanging out in the bathhouses doing work for AFH 14 years ago. We do, we're much more media savvy. We're using the internet a lot more. We had begun to do that work 14 years ago, but a lot more of the way that guys are interacting, especially around sex, is online. And so we have educators that work specifically with that program. In fact, our program is nationally recognized. And Eric Rowland, who was our director of education, has done talks and demonstrated the work that we've done at Legacy at the CDC and other places all over the country. So we were really kind of on the cutting edge of moving to that form. Yet you can never disengage. You need that personal contact, and how you work with people is certainly important. So we're still out in places where gay men congregate to talk to them. Now, we do the same with every population that we do prevention work. So whether it's African Americans or Hispanics, the injecting drug community, we're out there reaching the people, but making sure that we're meeting them on their terms, their space, and delivering a message that promote safety, but does not put them down or make them feel less for being gay or injecting drugs.
But there was also a challenge of funding when it was focused on abstinence only or not necessarily focusing on gay men.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly you have the expertise of working both on the government side and working for a clinic.
Right. Yeah, no, it's... You know, I say it a lot, and I don't want to say I'm partisan, but thank God the Bush years are over. That was a hard time. It was hard to even begin conversations about HIV with the leadership in Washington during his administration. The funding and abstinence only, whether you see it from the federal government, not which has now been reduced and zeroed out, but what goes on at the state level. We still face challenges there and funding of programs that are less than effective. So we're constantly out there putting a sex-positive message, whether it's for the programs that we apply or standing up and talking to the school board of the state of Texas.
Well, we're still challenged in providing health care to children, which is mostly mostly federally government-funded, that we can't even do the matching.
Right. So you know, we leave money, you know, Texas leaves money on the table, whether it's for the CHIP program, which provides health care to low-income children. We turned half a billion dollars in money that would have started a high-risk pool. In Texas, unemployment, food stamps, education, Texas government has put a block on Texas dollars coming back to Texas.
Crazy.
Yeah, no.
That's all I'm gonna say.
Texas is the state that has the most to gain under health care reform. And I'm lucky that I get to be in this conversation both at the federal and the state level where a lot will be determined. And I will be there talking about specifically and reminding people that HIV needs to be addressed. There are the way Medicaid functions right now, a three-drug limit would not necessarily work for a majority of our clients. And where will that additional funding come? Will we have to do more private fundraising? Will Ryan White be there to supplement the gaps that stay around? These are questions that we have to determine. And to me, I wish we had the answers now, but we have to wait till the Texas legislature goes into session in 2011 to work on a lot of these things.
So if a person needs help, can they get help, or are an organization like yours and the AIDS Foundation and many other ones stretch their limits?
Well, we're stretched to our limits, but philosophy we have in a lot of the ASOs in Houston, we don't turn people away. The process is a lot slower at times. And so the time which you get in to have an appointment or get your labs back is not as fast as we would like it. We would like to provide, turnaround the next day. You're in this, you have your options laid out in front of you. But the reality is we're booked up, and we have to put people in where we can get. And as we add more people to our roles and don't have the funds from the federal or the state government to expand the number of doctors or healthcare providers, whether it's nurse practitioners or psychologists, it takes longer for people.
And so, what about people who do have insurance but are afraid that if they turn in some of these requests for medication or to seeing doctors that they may be found out by their employer, especially smaller organizations? Where does that leave them?
Well, that's certainly something you have to take into consideration, but I think it's more important to make sure that you're getting those life-saving drugs. And more research is showing that the earlier you start treatment, and we've gone back and forth, treat hard, treat early, hold off, don't treat until you have to. The pendulum is swinging back to a treat hard, treat early, that you have to consider those options. Yes, your HR person may find out that you're living with AIDS. But the issue of stigma is something that we also do and advocate for. There are other organizations that are working on that issue in Houston as well.
Now, what can our listeners do? Is it an issue of getting the right people in office? I mean, do we need to change legislation? How do we proceed? And how do we go forward?
I've been doing presentations across the state over the past few months, and there's two things I've been talking to people about. And both of those relate to getting involved with advocacy during during the next legislative session of the Texas legislature. That begins in January 2011. And the two issues related to HIV that I'm talking to people about are, one, you need to be involved to push the issue of more funding for our Texas HIV medication program. That's funding that's done by the state and the federal government through Ryan White. We're expecting a shortfall. More people on the rolls, drugs more expensive, more people taking more drugs, and we will have to go to the legislature with our hands out saying we need anywhere from $10 to $30 million dollars extra this next legislative session.
And this is a legislative session that's going to be facing like an $18 billion shortfall.
And we have an $18 billion shortfall. And so that's what everyone is kind of drawing the lines in the sand. And the second issue is how Medicaid will be formed to cover those newly eligible. As I said earlier, 70% of our Ryan White clients will switch over to Medicaid. And how that is formed and how it treats people living with HIV. And then, of course, we'll have to be cognizant and continue that advocacy at the federal level when we reauthorize Ryan White and making sure that they merge together and that Ryan White is able to fill in the gaps, because Texas has a reputation for a Medicaid system that is not overly generous.
Right, right. So are you hopeful that we can work through this? And you're also in a nonprofit organization, but you do advocacy as much as you can.
Right. You know, I'm in a great job that I love, and that I'm out there promoting the work of Legacy with elected officials, teaching people within the community what we do. And I'm also able to call in people and educate on what needs to be done, grassroots lobbying. And we've seen a steady decline of that, I think, in HIV over the past 10, 15 years. I've only been in Houston 14 years, but this is a time when we need to ramp up and we need more people involved. And I'm the only one in Houston, in the state, at the Texas legislature full-time working on HIV as part of my portfolio. I'm doing other things that are important to low-income Texans and the LGBT community as well. So the hope is, and that people will get involved, and if you're interested in that, advocacy at legacycommunityhealth.org is a way that you can become involved. And our website, www.legacycommunityhealthservices.org, has an advocacy link as well.
And certainly as you worked with LGRL, and which is now Equality Texas, is that the people that really need to be talked to are the people outside the metropolitan areas that don't know that they have GLBT people or people with AIDS mm-hmm. living in their district.
Absolutely. In fact, that was an issue that I dealt with last session. I had a legislator who was in charge of how the issues were set, and she believed it did not affect her community. And therefore, we had trouble and had to push, sometimes publicly, sometimes behind the scenes, to make sure that our issues at least got a fair conversation.
We're talking to Randall Ellis. And Randall Ellis, what is your exact title?
Senior Director of Government Relations for Legacy Community Health Services.
Is that sort of like senior correspondent for The Daily Show?
That's, yeah.
We just know you as Randall Ellis.
As you know, Jack, I like to add humor to a lot of the news I have to deliver and
sure.
in my interactions. And some people don't get it, and other people understand and realize that it kind of makes some of this hard work doable.
Well, certainly you've been an asset to this community and the work that you do. And the effort that you put towards it. Randall, and you just said, how do we get in contact with you?
You can send an email to advocacy@legacycommunityhealthservices, or you can also just visit our website. There's a link for advocacy on www.legacycommunityhealthservices.org, and you can send an email from that link as well.
And Randall Ellis, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Queer Voices.
I am the mother of Matthew Shepard. He was my son, my friend, my confidant, my constant reminder of how good life can be. He was murdered in October 1998 because he was gay. There was just something about him that just made people want to talk to him, want to share, want to be his friend. You measure a person's success by the friends they leave behind. Well, I think that was a great success.
Seen him playing in his backyard, young boy just starting out. So much history in this landscape. So much confusion, so much doubt. Been there drinking on that front porch. Angry kids, mean and dumb. Looks like a painting, that blue skyline. God hates facts where we come from. Western sky, don't make it right. I'm off the grid, don't make no sense. I've seen a scarecrow wrapped in a wire, left to die on a high ridge fence. It's a cold, cold world. It's a cold, cold world. It's a cold wind blows. Why hold me? See two coyotes running down. Give us your children, but it's your blood that stains their hands. Western skies don't make it right. Home of the brave don't make no sense. I've seen the scarecrow wrapped in a wire. Let them die on a high ridge fence. It's a cold, cold world. It's a cold, cold world. It's a cold wind blow. Wyoming. Somewhere that road forks up ahead. To ignorance and innocence. Three lives drift on different winds. Two lives ruined, one life spent. Western skies don't make a right. I'm out to breathe, don't make no sense. In a while, let them die on a high ridge fence. It's a cold, cold world. It's a cold, cold world. It's a cold wind blowing. Wyoming. It's a cold, cold world. It's a cold, cold world. It's a cold wind blowing.
This is Queer Voices.
And this is Jennifer Renee.
And Brian Levinka.
And we're very fortunate to have in our studio with us, director of the Laramie Project, Joe Watts. And Joe is, what can I say, you are Theater New West. That's just the best way to put it, isn't it?
Yes, that's the best way to put it.
And in our studio also, we've got Derek Brent, Jordan Jaffe, and Nora Hahn, who are performing in the Laramie Project. And first of all, the Laramie Project. There are people out there that have no clue what that's about. Joe, what's it about?
Well, it's about the murder of the gay student at the University of Wyoming in Laramie. Surprisingly, more people know about the story than you might think. Because as I've gone around, and not necessarily in gay places, putting out my poster and some cards, and I would like, do you know what this is about? Do you know? And they were like, yeah, the kid in Laramie. Yeah, I know. I was amazed about how many people knew it.
Oh, and the key is that the people out there at Laramie, they maybe still have a question mark. This is about Matthew Shepard. And people that don't know will know that. And now, who wrote this?
A theater company from New York. What are they called, Nora?
Tectonic Theater Company.
And they went to Laramie, and their leader's name is what?
Moises Kaufman.
She's my backup. I can't handle anything.
She's the information source.
Yeah. Right after the murder, the theater company went to Laramie and conducted 200 interviews with people in the community, those that were involved in the case and those that were not. They went back several times for all these interviews, and they put it together and made it a very beautiful, dramatic piece of theater. The year it came out, it was the most produced play in America. And it's literally been done around the world, and has been done a lot at colleges and universities. I even got an email from a teacher who says she teaches the play.
That's incredible. Teaches the play to
students.
To the story, mm-hmm. The circumstances.
And what it represents, social injustice and hate crimes.
Now, when are y'all performing this? What are the dates of the performance?
We open June 24th on a Thursday for Pride Week. And we have sort of a strange schedule. We're at the Holocaust Museum. We're performing at the Holocaust Museum.
So that's over on Caroline.
Right. And we can't do Fridays there because of the...
No. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we do Thursdays and Saturdays. So the first weekend is June 24th, which is a Thursday, and then June 26th, which is a Saturday. But we're dark 4th of July weekend, and we don't come back until July 10th, which is a Saturday. And that's the performance of a lifetime.
Now, there's somebody special. You have some special guests there that night
for
the July the 10th.
Extremely special. This is very rare. This doesn't happen very often. But Judy Shepard, Matthew's mother, is coming in for our production. And she wrote a book that came out last fall. I don't have the title in front of me.
The Meaning of Matthew is the short version.
Right. My Son's Murder something. Anyway, she wrote a book, and on the evening of July 10th at the Holocaust Museum, Judy Shepard will be there, and she will have a book signing, and she will speak before the performance, and our wonderful new mayor, Anise Parker, will introduce Judy from the stage and welcome her to Houston, and then Judy will give a talk before the production, but she will not see it. She can't.
I think I could understand that.
It took her 8 years before she could see the play for the very first time.
Incredibly traumatic. It's a lot of emotion in there. I mean, you know, if even that many years, it's tough to get past that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in our studio, we have actors that are playing roles in the play. What roles are y'all playing?
I can introduce them, but Do you want me to introduce them as they read their short piece?
Yeah, to let our audience know. So you'll get a taste and a flavor of the show. Mm-hmm. Each one of the individuals here. Joe, that'll work fine. You can introduce them, and then you can do your little snippet from the play so that everyone out there that's listening can get a feel for it.
I tried to bring a cross-section of three different characters from the production, and the first one is Derek Brent is reading Doc O'Connor, and Doc O'Connor is a limousine driver, and it sort of speaks for itself. So,
and who's
Derek?
Derek Brent.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Well, on the 2nd of October, I get a call about 10 after 7. It was Matthew Shepard, you know, and he asked me could I pick him up at the corner of 3rd and Grand. So, anyhow, I pull up to the corner to see who, Matthew Shepard, you know, and it's a little guy, about 5'2", soaking wet, I bet you 97 pounds tops. They say he weighed 110 pounds, but I wouldn't believe it. They also said he was 5'5 in the newspapers, but this man, he was really only about 5'2, maybe 5'1. So, anyhow, he walks up to the window. I'm going to try to go in steps so you can better understand the principle of this man. So, he walks up to the window, and I asked him, I said, "Are you Matthew Shepard?" And he said, "Yeah, I'm Matthew Shepard, but I don't want you to call me Matthew or Mr. Shepard. I don't want you to call me anything. My name is Matt. And I want you to know that I am gay, and we are going to a gay bar. Do you have a problem with that?" And I said, "How are you paying?" See, the fact is, Laramie doesn't have any gay bars, and for that matter, neither does Wyoming. So he was hiring me to take him to Fort Collins, Colorado, about an hour away. Matt was a blunt little guy, you know. He always was. But that's why I liked him. He was always straightforward. You see what I'm saying? Maybe gay, but straightforward. You see what I'm saying?
Thank you.
And next we have Norhan is reading the character of Reggie Flutie. She was the policewoman who responded to the 911 call and discovered Matthew at the fence.
I responded to the call. When I got there, at first the only thing I could see was partially somebody's feet, and I got out of my vehicle and raced over. I seen what appeared to be a young man, 13, 14 years old, because he was so tiny, laying on his back, and he was tied to the bottom end of a pole. I did the best I could. The gentleman that was laying on the ground, Matthew Shepard, he was covered in dry blood all over his head. There was dry blood underneath him, and he was barely breathing. He was doing the best he could. I was going to breathe for him. I couldn't get his mouth open. His mouth wouldn't open for me. He was covered in, like I said, partially dry blood and blood all over his head. The only place that he did not have any blood on him, on his face, was what appeared to be where he'd been crying down his face.
That's one powerful. More. Powerful stuff.
Yeah. And our last character, Jordan Jaffe is playing this character. His name is Rulon Stacy. And he was the CEO of the Padre Valley Hospital in Fort Collins, where Matthew was transferred to. And this is more or less about an experience he had after Matthew passed away and some of the reactions that he had.
And there I am, and I'm thinking, this is so lame. And then we started to get people sending us emails and letters, and most of them were generally very kind, but I did get this one. This guy wrote me and said, "Do you cry like a baby on TV for all your patients, or just the faggots?" And as I told you before, homosexuality is not a lifestyle with which I agree. But having been thrown into this, I guess I didn't understand the magnitude with which some people hate. And of all the letters we got, there were maybe two or three that were like that. Most of them were, thank you for your caring and compassion. And Matthew had caring and compassion from the moment he got here.
Powerful stuff. And what can you say? Where do they contact you to get tickets for this?
The same number they've been contacting me for about 26 years.
Oh, and what is it? For those who are emotionally...
It's on all kinds of walls all over town. 713?
I don't go into the men's restroom anymore. Sorry.
I'm not going to go there either. 713-522-2204.
And is there a website?
Yes, there is, and it is very simply Theater New West, all is one word, and theater is R-E, so it's Theater New West at att.net.
I would like to hear from our participants, the actors here, you know, how do you feel? How has playing the part, doing the script? I know working with Joe, because I've worked with him before, we did it on the Vagina Monologues, you really get into the part and there's an impact on you. So why don't you just whichever one, if you can't make up your mind, I'll point. And how's this impacted your life?
This is Nora. I'll start off. For me, I have a friend who went to the University of Wyoming a little before Matthew was there, but I called her. I hadn't talked to her in years, and I said, you know, what was it like? I mean, do you remember that? And even though she had left, she remembered the incident very well, and even my 80-year-old dad remembered it. And so it just, you know, because it left such a mark on the world and on our lives, and I think I told Joe in the company when we first started, I have a little boy, and I want him to understand life is not, you know, Gary, Indiana. There's a real world out there, and we all need to know how to cope, how to love, how to understand and accept. And so, for me, it's been kind of a fun game of trying to find the real people and understand more about them and what they went through. And I sent Joe an email today, and I said, I found the real Reggie Flutie. I found some clips of her talking about the experience, and it just really helps you live through another person kind of vicariously for a small period of time. And then it's also a great way to learn how to tell a story. You know, maybe didn't have the ending you wanted, but it does have, it continues on. And it just gives you the chance to learn how the story went and now what's happening with the foundation and the play. It just... You know, it wasn't the kind of thing we want to happen, but gosh, what a chance to learn something and keep changing and try to make a mark on the world in our own little postage stamp of the community of Houston, Texas.
All right, thank you. And yeah, Joe?
Well, just let me say first, one of the reasons that there's some new information out there, updated information, is that the same theater company went back to Laramie 10 years later, and they have a new play called The Laramie Project. 10 years later, and I hope to be doing that in the fall. It's sort of
great.
More or less a sequel, and possibly with the same cast that I'm using now. Jordan, how is this affecting you? What are you getting from this?
You know, Matthew Shepard was 21 years old when he was murdered. I'm 22 myself, and I just look around at just think like the life that I've had and how lucky I've been, and I look at all my friends who are, you know, the same age, and to think that someone out there just took that from someone else, and it just really, I don't know, it just hits home. And
go ahead.
Oh, and you know, I just feel so lucky that I've had the opportunity to be a part of this play in this production.
Yeah. Derek, tell us.
Yes, well, first of all,
you got a great radio voice, by the way.
Thank you very much. Well, first of all, it's a it's a great blessing and experience to be a part of Theater New West in this project and in this production. But the way that this touches me the most is mostly the words and the reality of the words, not just of what happened, but in the stories that everyone is telling. It's not scripted. It's pure interviews, and it's real life. It's real life that we're staging for them. We're telling other stories, and that's where it really affects me, is the reality of the situation, from how they lived to how the state of the nation is from their perspective, to how this changed their whole entire environment, and how in the world of Matthew Shepard as well. You know, it's a voice of many, many people in this one production, and I loved it. I love the variety of life.
Well, one of the things I've gathered is that, you know, you're painting a picture of history, not from a story, but just from the interviews and the individuals who lived it. Joe, give us the dates of it and the contact information one more time.
All right. Basically, it runs June 24th through July 24th. The Thursday performances are at 7:30. The Saturday performances are at 8:00. There's one Sunday performance on July the 11th. It's a 6 o'clock.
And how do we get in touch with you?
For reservations and information, you can call 713-522-2204.
I want to thank Joe Watts, Derek Brandt, Jordan Jaffe, and Nora Hahn for coming in here for the Laramie Project. And this is Queer Voices.
Thank you. There was news this week in the Proposition 8 saga, this time regarding the high-profile federal lawsuit testing the constitutionality of California's anti-marriage equality initiative. According to published reports, it will only be a few weeks after hearing closing arguments on June 16th that presiding Judge Vaughn Walker will issue his ruling in the closely watched trial. The case is ultimately expected to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. Mormons accounted for over 71% of the campaign contributions in support of Prop 8, although they make up just 2% of California's population. A new documentary debuting on U.S. screens this month explores that imbalance and the forces that halted state Supreme Court mandated same-gender marriages. This Way Out, Steve Pride spoke with the film's producer and two of its subjects.
Supporters of Proposition 8, the ban on same-sex marriage, are claiming victory.
We're glad to have the victory.
A big victory for the LDS Church, a church that played one of the most prominent roles in the Say Yes on Prop 8 battle. Raised some $22 million to get the initiative passed.
We think it was the right thing to do.
They have gone ahead to stop performing same-sex marriages.
As California's anti-gay marriage Proposition 8 languished in the polls, Mormon prophet Thomas S. Munson issued a call from Salt Lake City to millions of Mormons all over the world. The action alert commanded Mormons in and out of California to do all things necessary to ensure the passage of California's Proposition 8. Within days, hundreds of thousands of Mormons all over the United States funneled $30 million Mormon dollars into California coffers, literally purchasing the passage of California's anti-gay constitutional amendment. The documentary 8, The Mormon Proposition, shines a light on the behind-the-scenes political mission of these Latter-day Saints.
About 1 year ago, I started getting emails from this stranger named Reed Cohen.
Producer Dustin Lance Black.
And they had attached these little quick times of initial edits of what he thought could be a documentary that would expose the church's involvement in Proposition 8. And I said, okay. And I sort of watched them and started growing more and more interested in the documents that they had uncovered. And the fact that it seemed like he was using the Mormon leadership's own voices to construct this accusation that they had formed this coalition and thus financed this campaign against gay and lesbian civil rights in California. And so I just got more and more interested. And finally, I guess I picked up the phone and said, hey, nice to meet you, Reed. You know, how can I help? And he asked if I would narrate. And then we started collaborating a bit on just what the message would be, like what the purpose of the film would be. And he was very gracious and receptive to some of my ideas. I mean, he and I both grew up devout Mormon and both ended up leaving the church, I think, mostly because of our sexuality.
Fred Karger, founder of Californians Against Hate.
I started following the money. That was an assignment I gave to myself because it had never been done in any of the other 28 elections where they're trying to take away marriage. And I discovered the Mormon involvement and how vast it was in every aspect of the campaign, not just the fundraising. And then after the election, I saw that they'd only declared $2,078 for all the work they'd done, the $30 million they'd raised, and again, taking over every part of that campaign. And so I started doing some digging. And for 9 days, I was holed up in my house, and I submitted a complaint to the California Fair Political Practices Commission, which is the state ethics board that looks at election irregularities. Well, they only investigate less than 5% of the complaints given to them. 8 days later, I got a letter from Roman Porter saying that we are going to investigate the Mormon Church. And that...
There was news this week in the Proposition 8 saga, this time regarding the high-profile federal lawsuit testing the constitutionality of California's anti-marriage equality initiative. According to published reports, it will only be a few weeks after hearing closing arguments on June 16th that presiding Judge Vaughn Walker will issue his ruling in the closely watched trial. The case is ultimately expected to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. Mormons accounted for over 71% of the campaign contributions in support of Prop 8, although they make up just 2% of California's population. A new documentary debuting on U.S. screens this month explores that imbalance and the forces that halted state Supreme Court-mandated same-gender marriages. This Way Out, Steve Pride spoke with the film's producer and two of its subjects.
Supporters of Proposition 8, the ban on same-sex marriage, are claiming victory.
We're glad to have the victory.
A big victory for the LDS Church, a church that played one of the most prominent roles in the Say Yes on Prop 8 battle. Raised some $22 million to get the initiative passed.
We think it was the right thing to do.
They have gone ahead to stop performing same-sex marriages.
As California's anti-gay marriage Proposition 8 languished in the polls, Mormon prophet Thomas S. Munson issued a call from Salt Lake City to millions of Mormons all over the world. The action alert commanded Mormons in and out of California to do all things necessary to ensure the passage of California's Proposition 8. Within days, hundreds of thousands of Mormons all over the United States funneled $30 million Mormon dollars into California coffers, literally purchasing the passage of California's anti-gay constitutional amendment. The documentary 8, The Mormon Proposition, shines a light on the behind-the-scenes political mission of these Latter-day Saints.
About 1 year ago, I started getting emails from this stranger named Reed Cohen.
Producer Dustin Lance Black.
And they had attached these little quick times of initial edits of what he thought could be a documentary that would expose the church's involvement in Proposition 8. And I said, okay. And I sort of watched them and started growing more and more interested in the documents that they had uncovered and the fact that it seemed like he was using the Mormon leadership's own voices to construct this accusation that they had formed this coalition and thus financed this campaign against gay and lesbian civil rights in California. And so I just got more and more interested. And finally, I guess I picked up the phone and said, hey, nice to meet you, Reed. You know, how can I help? And he asked if I would narrate, and then we started collaborating a bit on just what the message would be, like what the purpose of the film would be, and he was very gracious and receptive to some of my ideas. I mean, he and I both grew up devout Mormon and both ended up leaving the church, I think, mostly because of our sexuality.
Fred Karger, founder of Californians Against Hate.
I started following the money. That was an assignment I gave to myself because it had never been done in any of the other 28 elections where they're trying to take away marriage. And I discovered the Mormon involvement and how vast it was in every aspect of the campaign, not just the fundraising. And then after the election, I saw that they'd only declared $2,078 for all the work they'd done, the $30 million they'd raised, and again, taking over every part of that campaign. And so I started doing some digging, and for 9 days, I was holed up in my house, and I submitted a complaint to the California Fair Political Practices Commission, which is the state ethics board that looks at election irregularities. Well, they only investigate less than 5% of the complaints given to them. 8 days later, I got a letter from Roman Porter saying that we are going to investigate the Mormon Church. And that just came to a head after 19 months, and they have found the Mormon Church guilty of 13 counts of campaign reporting violations, and they're being fined, and it's unprecedented. In spite of church denials with my complaint when I filed it, they attacked me personally, said my complaint was false and misleading. Well, then they kind of backed away from that after the investigation was announced, and of course did so again on the website when it was released that they were found guilty.
But publicly, the Mormon Church's lead role in this political battle was obscured by their formation of a coalition of churches in opposition.
Coalition is a nice term for what we in the political business call a front group. Behind every successful coalition is someone paying the bills and pulling the strings, and that's the Mormon Church. And I was not quite as aware of that until I received hundreds and hundreds of Mormon documents, official church documents, that depicted their role in fighting same-sex marriage going back to 1995 in Hawaii, and how blatant they were and arrogant in disregarding the laws. And they're on our website, MormonGate.com. You can take a look for yourself. My jaw dropped when I started reading these things, and it never quite recovered. And they got caught in California. They had not in any of the other states. And so it's this blatant disregard for the law and their arrogance and pulling together this coalition. They knew they surveyed poorly with the general public. The church has always been controversial, and they did a lot of research, and they saw the Catholics, which there are a lot more of and held higher in public esteem, surveyed better. So they approached the Catholic Church. There was a big powwow that then church president Gordon Hinckley had at his Hawaii estate with a cardinal from California. And that's when the deal was cemented to fight the Hawaii Amendment back in 1998, that election was. And ever since, it's just grown. And we're seeing now frightening alliance of the Catholics and Mormons coming together. The Mormons really wanted to show the religious world, the evangelicals particularly, that they ruled. And they did so by taking over every single aspect of this campaign, particularly, you know, $30 million of the $40 million that was raised from church membership. But they did all the commercials. The kids were Mormon. The law professor was Mormon. I mean, all the participants, all the experts that were caravanning all over California and bus trips and everything, all Mormon. The famous commercial, the gathering storm, which was after the election.
There's a storm gathering.
The clouds are dark.
And I am afraid. My freedom will be taken away.
I am a Massachusetts parent, helplessly watching public schools teach my son that gay marriage is okay.
I will have no choice.
The storm is coming.
You know, I get all these tips. I had a blogger tell me, and all documented, and it's been released, that 11 of the 13 participants in the Gathering Storm commercial, which has been parodied quite a bit, are Mormon actors from Arizona. So, you know, they haven't backed away too much in Maine. The very first election post-California, they did announce they were not participating, which also turned out to be false. And their pollster, Gary Lawrence from Orange County here, did all the polling on Prop 8, was the pollster there. The Worthlands, who were the family in the commercial here, did a commercial for the Maine election, and the money, we don't know where it came from. They've hidden that, refused to three federal judges who've ordered them to turn it over. The state attorney general of Maine, the National Organization for Marriage, which is the Mormon front group, will not release the name of their donors. So they're still playing. I'm hopeful that this decision by the Fair Political Practices Commission will dissuade them from any further election activity.
Hello, I'm CJ Cox, director of Latter Days and Kiss the Bride, and you're listening to This Way Out Radio Magazine.
And I'm Steve Pry, talking to the producer and subjects of a new documentary, 8, The Mormon Proposition.
I'm Linda Stay. I'm mom and accidental activist. My son, Tyler, is my oldest of five. An amazing kid. He's a cardiac thoracic nurse at UCSF. Recently married. Well, they're still honeymooning, of course. They were married on the first day that it was legal in San Francisco, June 17th, 2008, which actually I didn't realize what would happen that day, how my life would change. It was exciting, and it wasn't long after that that, of course, the Mormon Church inserted itself into the same-sex battle. And being fifth-generation Mormon, it turned my life upside down.
If
Proposition 8 fails, there's a whole bunch of consequences.
If Proposition 8 passes, won't it take existing rights away from gay couples?
No rights will be taken away from same-sex partners if Proposition 8 passes.
If Proposition 8 fails, children will be taught that same-sex marriages are the equal of traditional marriages.
I learned how a prince married a prince, and I can marry a princess.
Teaching children about gay marriage will happen here unless we pass Proposition 8. Have you thought about what same-sex marriage means?
To me?
Think about it. Voting yes restores traditional marriage. Yes on Proposition 8.
Specifically, Mormons were directed to donate their means and time to the cause. And in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, that phrase has a very special meaning.
That's language that is used in the temple ceremonies, which are very private, sacred, and secret. You're not allowed to discuss anything that happens in the temple ceremonies. And so when that type of language is used, that's a directive from God. And in the temple, Mormons make commitments and covenants, is what they call them, to serve and to give all of their time and means. And so when they hear that terminology, it's as though they are being called on a mission for God.
And it was a mission that divided families, including Linda's.
They donated thousands for Proposition 8. I'm sorry. And as I pled with them, I said, this is Tyler we're talking about. Why are you doing this? And they agreed with me that, yes, Linda, I do agree. It is a civil rights issue, and this is really tough. But I have to err on the side of the prophet. My opinion doesn't matter. The thinking's been done, and I will always err on the side of the prophet. Those were their words. My sister said, you know I love him. You know I will always love him, but I just cannot condone this part. And I said, no, you're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to chop him up and to ease your own conscience, tell me that you love him, and then take these actions against his basic human right.
As a former Mormon myself, I know that when the leadership calls for the followers and the believers to do something, that they do.
Producer Dustin Lance Black.
Much of my family is still Mormon, so they, of course, would want to respond to that call to action as well. So it all made perfect sense to me that that's what was happening. We just didn't have any proof. So I guess what surprised me most was that Fred Karger was able to get these documents and that these filmmakers were able to get some of the quotes and some of the conversations from church leaders that they were able to get so that we could finally hold them accountable. I guess that was the biggest surprise, that we finally had proof that there was a calculated strategy that had been perpetrated in Hawaii, repeated in California, and then, of course, in Maine.
But the fallout from the church's anti-gay campaign has impact far beyond marriage rights in Hawaii, California, or Maine.
I remember when I was 6 years old hearing the prophet of the Mormon Church, they beam his address into the churches outside of Utah. I was out in San Antonio, Texas, and one Sunday he said that homosexuality was compared to the sin of murder. And when you hear that sort of thing, and I'm here to tell you, being gay or lesbian, it's built in, it's not a changeable attribute. And when you hear that about yourself as a child, it's incredibly damaging to your self-esteem. And it's not surprising to me that a lot of young people today still seriously contemplating taking their own lives.
And for Fred Karger, whose investigation is the basis of the film?
I can't deliver a revelation, no one can, but I think we can certainly keep the public and political pressure on them to get them to back away from fighting gay marriage.
This has been a conversation with Dustin Lance Black, Fred Karger, and Linda Stay. On June 9th, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints was ordered to pay a very small fine for failing to properly report just some of their contributions, supporting the passage of Proposition 8, banning same-sex marriages in California. 8, the Mormon Proposition, opens in select U.S. theaters June 18th and will be released on DVD July 13th. Find more info at their website, mormonproposition.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
How the world can change.
You have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 9 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles, and J.D. Doyle's Queer Music Heritage, which is produced in Houston. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Falinski. On-air voices are Brian Levinka, Jennifer Renee, J.D. Doyle, Glenn Holt, Summer Iman, and Jack Falinski. For more information about tonight's program, including links to websites and organizations mentioned during the show, visit queervoices.org. And you can send email to jack@queervoices.org. Be sure to listen to KPFT every Sunday morning, starting at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston, a Pacifica Foundation station. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
This year, the Pacifica Foundation, the parent organization of this station, is holding elections to seat boards of directors in each of the foundation's five signal areas. These local station boards help shape the direction of this station. Your vote makes a difference. Please note the date of record that closes eligibility for voting is coming up June 30th. The date of record is the time when new members must be on the rolls for this election. If you qualify as a staff member, this supersedes the listener category of membership. Please make sure to log your volunteer hours in